Brett Hollander back here on WBAL. We are with Dave Ungrady, an author of the book, Born Ready, The Mixed Legacy of Len Bias. So he's drafted by the Celtics, Dave.
He's going to the Celtics, the defending NBA champions. And so there was a lot of hype surrounded about him and a lot of expectations. He had a very outgoing personality. People loved him. So all those confluence of factors made him they create a lot of hype, a lot of expectations, and when he died, everything was just deflated. And no athlete had really died that way before. No athlete of prominence died that way with cocaine.
And I think about it even now, and that's the point I was going to actually make next. If that happened today, we look at all the stories that get blown up. Some are important, some are not important, that ESPN turns into something that's important. You look at Richie Incognito and Jonathan Martin, and this is a young man who is about to start probably a very, very accomplished NBA career, and he dies doing drugs one night. I can only imagine what that would be like. I'm not sure. It took University of Maryland back then a long time to recover. I'm not sure if it does recover in today's world.
It's recovered. Oh, in today's world, actually, you know what? I think it wouldn't have as much of an impact because
Really? There's
more knowledge about the impact of drugs and athletes now. It's hard to go a week without reading about a prominent athlete who is either arrested for drugs
True. Or
has drug issues or some kind of an issue like that. There were athletes, probably, I wouldn't be surprised, more drug use than by athletes. It just wasn't known as much. You didn't have social media to let people know what's going on or to talk about themselves to really, you know, sort of indict themselves what they're doing. But the NBA in the late 1970s was very concerned about its drug use, cocaine use already. You remember David Thompson out of North Carolina State?
Sure.
He wrecked his career because he was addicted to drugs and alcohol. He fell down the stairs in the late 1970s, Studio 54, and I write about it in the book. And he racked up his knee, and that was the end of his career. Like, a year later, he was out.
And we know about the stories in baseball, NBA, and in that era specifically. And then also, even if you watched the recent 30 for 30 about the St. Louis Spirits of the ABA, mm-hmm. I mean, that was a league and a team that specifically really overcome by drug use.
And cocaine at that time, Brian, it's important to note that it was still considered a recreational drug. Not enough was known about it or the perils of it. When Len died, that changed everything. How teams started reacting to scouting players. 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, and I address this in the book. It's common knowledge for anybody who knows Len's story. It was passed in October, 3 or 4 months later, directly as a result of Len's death. And what that did is it changed the mandatory minimum sentences for recreational drug users, possessors, a conspiracy for drugs. If you had 5 grams of crack cocaine, your minimum sentence in prison was 5 years. If you had 500 grams of powder cocaine, you had the same sentence. So it skewed against a lot of young black people in the inner cities, in the poor areas, and that is a big reason why there's an overcrowded prison population now.
We are with Dave Ungrady, the author of a book, Born Ready, The Mixed Legacy of Len Bias. And coming up on Monday, November 18th at 5:30, Dave will be speaking at the Sports Legends Museum at Camden Yards. And for more information, you can contact Ashley S. at BabeRuthMuseum.org or call 410-727-1539. That's 410-727-1539. And going back to the drug part of the story, the ending of the story, you were saying how he used it recreationally leading up to his death. How prevalent was it with the University of Maryland basketball team, Maryland Athletics, and Len Bias?
The athletic department claims pretty much ignorance about his drug use. And I'm not surprised because at that time, Maryland did have a drug testing program, athletic department, one of the few in the country that did, but it was very random. It wasn't very sophisticated. And at that time, and I still think to an extent today, athletic department officials will look the other way if they hear something bad about someone, unless they really see that there's a problem. Len, again, he was showing no signs of being addicted. The strength coach at that time at Maryland was Frank Costello, who was my coach, head coach, track coach at Maryland. Frank told me he never missed a training session. He was working out hard. He never showed any typical signs of being addicted. He showed up to practice, went to games, played well, of course. In my research, I was able to determine that he was classified as a recreational user, as I mentioned before. There's a woman who claims, and I say claim because there's never been a definitive proof There's not going to be a DNA test, but claims to be the mother of his only son, who right now is 27 years old. She met him in September of 1985 and soon got pregnant, she claims, by him. And I saw the birth certificate. Len's name is on it. That's the only really definitive proof, plus whatever they say. She says, and I've confirmed with other people who knew the situation, not only who know the family, but also know, not Len's family, but also know the woman, that yes, that's the truth. And I met the son.
Is the Bias family denying that?
They never responded to that.
And so, they don't have an impact on this child's life in any way?
To my knowledge, they met him a couple times from what people told me, and there was nothing beyond that. There was little interest in them beyond meetings in the first 2 or 3 years.
So this kid's about my age now, right?
He's 27, and he's been incarcerated. He's had drug problems. And he claims that not having known who his father was a big problem. Knowing that Len Bias was his father, not knowing him, created a problem. Now, I'm sure there was more to it. But this woman says that when she was with Len the last 9 months of his life, she said quite a bit, she saw him use it up to twice a week. People still believe, and I go to a lot of tournaments and sell the book, youth tournaments, and they ask, I heard it was the first time. It's not the case. Lefty Drizel still believes it's the first time he ever used it. He'll believe that to his grave.
No question. Nothing you can say to Lefty would ever change that in his mind.
No, I don't think it ever would. As an anecdote, remember Chris Washburn? In 1986, he was a sophomore at North Carolina State. Mm-hmm. He was the number 3 pick in the 1986 draft, one behind Len. I talked to Chris because I knew as soon as after he was drafted by the Golden State Warriors, he lasted 2 years because he had a cocaine problem. So I called him to ask him, did Len's death affect your cocaine use at all? He said, look, man, I was an addict. It scared me a bit, but it didn't stop me. And he said, by the way, Len Bias introduced me to cocaine. In April of 1986 at an All-Star game that Leonard was on a circuit down there, knocked on Chris's door at 3 a.m. Get up, we're getting high. And Chris said his response was, it's Len Bias. I'm not going to say no to Len Bias. So he had that kind of power over people. He was a domineering figure. And even in the trial, the Brian Tribbles trial,
right?
Terry Long and David Gregg, who were with Len when Len died, they testified that Len introduced them to cocaine up to 18 months prior to Len's death. So there is, on the record, there is testimony that Len was a previous user. And anecdotal, evidence that he was a previous user.
Fascinating. When we come back, what is the legacy for Len Bias and his coach at the University of Maryland, Lefty Drizel? That is next here on Sportsline.